Nuclear really occupies the headlines today around its use in things like weapons. And really, uranium has been used in nuclear power now since the 1950s. China is now approving and building between 8 and 10 new reactors per year. This is a number that the Western mind can't really comprehend. China will overtake the US as the largest consumer of uranium, probably just before 2030. The ambition that they're trying to fulfill is to go from about 60 gigawatts of installed capacity today to 150 within the next 10 years. Emerging demand in places like India. India wants to increase nuclear capacity tenfold from about 3% of their grid today. Has a very, very ambitious nuclear power program. But if we look at it holistically, over 30 countries now have pledged to triple nuclear capacity based on today's levels.
As the world fragments into what Ocean Wall calls a molecular war, a contest fought not with armies but with atoms, isotopes, and the materials that underpin modern industry, few sectors illustrate the stakes more clearly than the role of nuclear fuel and uranium in solving the energy equation. All of the industries primed for important growth need energy to extract, to run, to produce, and to electrify. Western economies remain structurally exposed. Supply chains are concentrated, geopolitics is weaponized, and the repricing of critical materials is accelerating. Ocean Wall has been early and vocal in arguing that uranium sits in the same strategic bucket as helium, tungsten, and metallurgical coal, along with others, assets whose scarcity, indispensability, and geopolitical choke points create asymmetric investment opportunities. Today we want to understand that thesis, examine the evidence, explore and understand if this is the moment where the nuclear investment cycle may be poised for a potential upswing, and a potent one at that, and why 5T, the fund on which Ocean Wall advises, offers one route to gain exposure to the investment theme. To help explain that thesis, we're delighted to welcome Ben Feingold, Director at Ocean Wall. Ben, welcome to this curated edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Pleasure to be here.
So I have been quite familiar with the uranium thesis for a while as an investor, but you know myself. You have written some very good stuff, and I'm going to refer, for those who are watching on YouTube, this is Ocean Wall's piece of research called The Tide, which talks about a number of investment themes, of which obviously nuclear sits fairly center. So, but let's start this conversation top down and just explain a little bit what has been going on in the last few decades, supply and demand. Let's start with the supply side. Mm-hmm.
So I think, to your point around uranium, it's played this fundamental role in global energy transition dating back really to the 1970s. And obviously, I think most people are familiar with uranium more recently through the film Oppenheimer, where you got to see really the creation of the first atomic bomb, and you got to see the very, very early days of using uranium and this incredibly energy-dense fuel. For sort of some context around uranium, a single pellet the size of about a gummy bear has the same energy as a ton of coal, 17,000 cubic feet of natural gas, and 149 gallons of oil. So it's incredibly energy dense. And the supply side for uranium and for nuclear fuel has really changed over time. But what we have seen happen increasingly in the last two decades is a market that has become bifurcated between the East and the West on the supply side. And I'm sure that we'll talk about some of the nuances around that. But on the demand side, we've seen, if you look, nuclear really occupies the headlines today around its use in things like weapons. And really, uranium has been used in nuclear power now since the 1950s, since the sort of Atoms for Peace initiative post the conclusion of World War II. And those first of a kind reactors came online in the mid 50s, first in Russia and then here in the UK. And then in the US by the end of the 1950s. And there was this huge build out through the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s that started to require, obviously, significantly higher volumes of nuclear fuel, which was something that we never had to really produce at an industrial scale, whether that's mined uranium, converted uranium, enriched uranium. So it's one of those, it's a supply demand story that has changed significantly over time, but we believe is sort of starting to crescendo, if it were, as the world really turns back towards nuclear power today.
So I'm going to dive into both the supply and demand in more detail. Just for those of us who are less familiar with, if not the chemistry of the terminology, and I have no record on doing very well at chemistry a very long time ago, U is the chemical symbol, but U308 is is, I think, how it's referred to. I'd like you just to explain, just first of all, say whether I'm right or wrong, and also explain the spot and forward market or the term market, because this is an unusual duality as well. And people often look at maybe the spot price, which is the wrong thing to look at.
So you are absolutely correct. So you have natural uranium in the ground, and think about that as it sort of obviously looks very metallic, and you get these little bits of sort of yellowish hue in that metal. That then gets milled and crushed down into what is essentially natural uranium or uranium oxide, so U308. But that is essentially useless to the nuclear reactors in the world today. You can't run, or very, very few reactors can run on just natural uranium. So it has to go through a process of conversion, first of all, which is turning U308 into a gas. And then it goes through a process of enrichment, which is essentially spinning that gas incredibly fast to isolate the isotope that you want. Now, this is going to test the chemistry of most people, myself included, when I first started to look at it. The isotope U-235, which is the fissile isotope, which is the isotope you really care about. In its natural form, uranium is only enriched in that isotope to about 0.7%, i.e. it's not very radioactive. We need to take that from 0.7% in its natural form to about 4-5% in order for it to become serviceable nuclear fuel. And for those familiar with the Oppenheimer movie, he sort of does this through his marbles in a jar analogy. And if you want to get to weapons grade uranium, you have to go to about 90% U-235. The contract market is split, as you said, between spot and term. Think about nuclear utilities, so nuclear power plants. They do about 90% of their contracting in what's called the term market. The term market is for delivery 12 months forward. Now, that doesn't mean 12 months to 24 months, but actually you can see term contracts written as far away as 2040 today, so 15 plus year contracts. And that gives you a sense of the cycle, the lead time that you need to produce uranium. The spot market is for near-term delivery, so at spot, as you'll see in most other commodity markets. And that is really quite it's an opaque market, but it's also very, very thinly traded. Don't think about uranium in the context of oil and gas and lumber and these larger ancillary commodities. It's really a very, very small market. 200 million pounds, when I talk pounds, I mean weight per year, at $86 current spot price a pound. You realize that it's really a sort of line item on in terms of global commodities. But that's almost where we see the opportunity, given that uranium is the only fuel that powers 9% of the world.
Got it. I want to come back to supply. Where is this stuff?
So our journey has taken us to places like Kazakhstan, which is 40% of global uranium supply. So Kazakhstan is OPEC plus in oil language, but in uranium. So the world's largest producer by two times. The second largest producer in the world is Canada, which is about 20%, about 25% actually. And the only producer there is Cameco, and Cameco in a joint venture with Orano, the French state nuclear company. And then you have places like Australia, which actually has the world's largest proven uranium reserves, but has a moratorium domestically on nuclear power. So not particularly interested in ramping up production. Actually, the main production that comes out of Australia, the overwhelming majority, is a byproduct of a copper mine called Olympic Dam, which is run by BHP. And then also you have some African countries like Namibia, like Niger, that also account for, call it single digit percentage. And maybe one I forgot actually just below Kazakhstan is Uzbekistan, which is looking at ramping up production quite significantly.
So that's where the supply sits. Let's talk about how hard it is to get it out of the ground and where we sit, because there was a decommissioning of nuclear weapons from Russia, which created supply. Where are we in the aggregate supply creation?
So think about global annual supply. Primary supply is about 160 million pounds. I mentioned sort of circa 200 million pounds of primary demand. Supply is, it's not like any other commodity in the world in so much as what you can do with uranium in the end use case. So it's classified as what's called class 7 transit material, which means that it's radioactive, and obviously it can be used for things like weapons. The last I checked, you can't do that with gold, you can't do that with silver. And so it falls under a completely different level of regulatory scrutiny and complexity versus any other commodity. So the average lead time to, once you've discovered your uranium deposit in, let's say, the Athabasca Basin, which is the highest grade uranium jurisdiction in the world in Canada, the lead time from you finding that uranium to actually going through permitting, licensing, development, and production can be between 12 and 15 years. So we used to work with a business called Fission Uranium Corp. They discovered PLS, which is one of the highest grade uranium deposits ever discovered in the Athabasca. They discovered that in 2012. They won't produce pounds from that mine probably until early 2030s. So very, very long lead times. And this is part of the opportunity, but also, in our view, potentially part of the risk to the nuclear power thesis.
And that secondary market that came out of, nuclear weapons, is that largely exhausted?
So exactly. The megatons to megawatts program was a program in 1993, the downblending of that 90% number I spoke about down to the 5% number that you need for just traditional nuclear power. That program essentially downblended 20,000 nuclear warheads post the collapse of the USSR down into 5% enriched fuel. That program finished, I believe, in 2013. And so we're not looking to see, we don't have any visibility on another type, another program like that. And the obvious one that comes to mind is, are the Iranian stockpiles, is that going to be enough to have a megatons to megawatts 2.0? The numbers that we've looked at is that you're talking about 1 to 2 reloads if you downblended their entire highly enriched uranium stockpile. So we don't see that as a threat to this thesis.
So supply is constrained, it's long term, difficult to get out of the ground. That's I think difficult to dispute. Let's move to the demand side. We know, and for those of us who were, amazed, shocked, disappointed with Angela Merkel's decision to abandon, so much of that nuclear sort of program, there's a reappraisal going on. We'll get to some of the countries, but high level, paint the picture of where the demand is coming from.
So the largest consumer of uranium in the world today is still the United States. They account for about 50 million pounds of that 200 million pounds of demand. So call it 25% of global uranium demand comes from just the US. They have the largest nuclear fleet in the world, call it about 90 gigawatts of capacity, powers about 19% of their grid. So it's very much reliant on nuclear power. The 800-pound gorilla in the room, as in many other commodities now, is China. And China is building nuclear reactors at a rate that the world has really not seen since the 1970s and what the French did under Messimer. China is now approving and building between 8 and 10 new reactors per year. This is a number that the Western mind can't really comprehend. China will overtake the US as the largest consumer of uranium, probably just before 2030. And so the ambition that they're trying to fulfill is to go from about 60 gigawatts of installed capacity today to 150 within the next 10 years. Think about that in the context of, let's say, the UK market, where things like Hinkley Point and Sizewell C are taking close to 2 decades now. Look at Vogtle 3, Vogtle 4, which were the last two reactors to be built in the US. Those came in at $36 billion and took around 15 years. So China is really walking the walk in terms of the demand side, and they're also building reactors for about $3 billion a piece, which is significantly cheaper than anywhere else in the world. Emerging demand in places like India. India wants to increase nuclear capacity tenfold from about 3% of their grid today, has a very, very ambitious nuclear power program. France, I briefly touched upon. France is obviously quite a famous example for nuclear power, having had a build out from, I think it was 0 to 58 reactors in less than 20 years. This is something that, again, they did between the sort of 70s and the 80s. But if we look at it holistically, over 30 countries now have pledged to triple nuclear capacity based on today's levels. Most major economies that I've mentioned, and to your point, if you ask most Germans today whether they are happy with that decision to shutter their nuclear power plants, for obvious reasons, they would say no, because it really does provide something that no other power can provide, which is that firm baseload power that's obviously is obviously clean as well.
So there's one other country I just want to bring into the equation, because whenever you talk about nuclear, the people who have observed it over the years, they think about, Chernobyl, they think about, Three Mile Island, they think about, Japan. Morgan Stanley put out an interesting report the other day on the changing dynamics within the Japanese administration. Just touch on that.
So again, famous sort of moment in the history of nuclear power, Fukushima 2011. Japan, I think, we had the third largest fleet in the world there, 33 operating reactors. That collapsed post-Fukushima for obvious reasons. You had governments in Japan that went very, very anti-nuclear. And this has now been a complete U-turn by the recent Japanese governments. They now want to take nuclear back to well over 10% of their grid. And they obviously have this huge infrastructure installed base that really now needs to be recommissioned as opposed to starting from scratch. So that's a lot of the new near-term demand that we see for uranium and new near-term capacity that we see coming back online that is not online today.
Now, unlike the 1970s and 80s, we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have two other buyers who have cropped up. The financial community has arrived, hedge funds being part of it. And the way I own uranium is through the Sprott listed SRUUF physical vehicle listed on the New York Stock Exchange and on the Canadian Stock Exchange. Tell me a little bit about where those other actors are in the equation.
So back in 2006-07, one of the obviously big catalysts for the market beyond what was happening fundamentally and the flooding of Cigar Lake was the hedge funds starting to get involved. You know, Nick, my boss, and I describe them as sort of the apex predators when it comes to these types of commodity cycles. And what we started to see was hedge funds really didn't start to get interested until after these two physical listed funds came to market, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. But the first one to come to market was Yellowcake in this sort of second stage of nuclear. Back in the day, there was Nufcor, which ended up getting bought by Constellation. And now if you trade with Goldman Sachs, that's normally using the Nufcor pounds if you trade with their physical desk. Today, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust has over $6 billion worth of uranium essentially stockpiled and locked up. And I was in Monaco last week for the World Nuclear Fuel Conference and was listening to WMC, who are their traders, talking about what they intend to do with that uranium. And he sort of stood up in front of the utilities and said, for those who thought that I was going to stand up and say that Sprott pounds are for sale, they absolutely are not. So these physical funds are not purely speculating on price at a moment in time, but they are locking up that supply far, far into the future. In our home market in London, we have Yellowcake PLC, which is about 21, 22 million pounds. So it's about, call it a fifth of the size of Sprott. But these physical funds are attracting huge inflows from investors who really want what we would call Delta One exposure, just looking for the easiest way to play the physical uranium price. And unlike other more liquid commodities where you have futures markets, where you can paper trade these commodities, or you can even own physical, it's very, very hard to own physical. You have to set up an account with your domestic nuclear regulator. If there's a storage facility in the US or in places like France, then maybe you can play it that way. But we're starting to actually see some of the commodity traders coming into this space. So Mercuria accounted for about 25% of volume in the spot market in the first quarter of this year. So starting to see, as liquidity, I think, improves, starting to see a lot more financial interest.
So Cameco, I think it was their CEO, Grant Isaac, said utilities can delay and defer, but not avoid purchasing uranium. If you're sitting there as one of these big utilities, what's front and center of your thinking?
Your average fuel buyer is given a pretty simple instruction, which is ensure security of supply. And it comes down to this point that the fuel buyer is not necessarily paid to time the market or to get the best possible price for uranium, but they must secure supply. And this is because of two reasons. First of all, uranium represents about 5 to 7% of their overall running costs. So it's pretty price inelastic. They can pay $50 a pound, they can pay $150 a pound. And it's kind of at the margin in terms of their overall costs. The second reason is that there is no substitute. And this comes down to the point of price inelasticity. There is no substitute fuel for uranium. If you wanted to do a different type of fuel for the 440 operating reactors in the world today, you're talking about completely re-engineering these reactor designs. So this feeds into the mentality of the fuel buyers at these utilities, which is, of course, they understand the supply-demand dynamics, and of course, they understand that there is a deficit in markets, and that's why we've seen term prices, where they do 90% of their contracting, just steadily tick up month on month. It's reported on a monthly basis. We've seen it only fall 2 months in the last 5 years. And that was by about 50 cents on the month. So you very rarely see commodity prices move linear, but uranium term prices, i.e., for us, this has always been about term prices are indicative of utility uncertainty about future demand. Higher term prices, higher uncertainty. And so I think that the fuel buyers around the generation of 2011 who saw Fukushima and saw a 10-year bear market in uranium, perhaps are not as familiar with this sort of new world order in uranium, which is we just don't have this. We need two or three Kazakh-sized mines to come online to meet this to meet this deficit in the years ahead.
And we've seen governments like the US have strategic oil reserves. Is there much or any indication that we're going to see an appetite to build strategic reserves, you know, of uranium?
We've already seen it in China. They don't advertise it the same way that Mr. Trump would advertise a new strategic nuclear fuel reserve. But the Chinese actually started to build out capacity at something called Alashanku. Alashanku is a uranium bonded warehouse on the Kazakh Chinese border. That has capacity for about 60 million pounds of uranium. And so the Chinese have always been quite commodity greedy in that aspect. And so we've seen a sort of sovereign stockpiling already happening in China for the last sort of 5 or 6 years. We did see a US strategic reserve, I believe in 2022. That was about a million pounds of uranium. Can put that into the context of 50 million pounds of domestic consumption, and it didn't really move the needle. So in answer to your question, we haven't seen these sort of sovereign stockpiles like the Strategic Oil Reserve come about yet, but this is something that we expect to see as sovereigns grapple with the fact that they don't have domestic supply and that they need to start to secure their sort of nuclear future.
And so having diagnosed the supply-demand, you know, equation, is there anything that we've missed in that? In that analysis, because it is absolutely the underpinning of the thesis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing to mention is to reiterate on China. And China, they really think about procurement in terms of three lenses. What can we produce domestically? What can we joint venture abroad? And what assets can we own abroad? And then what can we go and buy in the market? And when you look at Africa, the sort of net new producers is really going to be Namibia over the next 5 or 10 years. There's various new high grade, sort of large scale mines coming online in Namibia over the next few years. And China have locked up 100% of supply coming out of Namibia. And so when we look at uranium supply demand, I don't view it as 200 million pounds of demand, 160 of supply on a global basis, but there's domestic deficit in places like the US, where they produce about 2% of what they consume. There are no two deficits that are the same. So China's fairly well covered. Japan also is fairly well covered. India just signed about, we estimate, $6 billion worth of contracts for uranium with the Kazakhs and with the Canadians. And so when we focus on where we see the biggest opportunities, which we'll talk about, I think that the US is obviously, US and North America, that domestic deficit is so much more significant than anywhere else.
And I was in Namibia a couple of years ago and you could actually see this going on. I think the other point that perhaps we haven't touched on is that whether it's Cameco or whether it's the Kazakh equivalent, mm-hmm. Am I right in saying that both of these entities have been cutting their forecast supply production?
Mm-hmm. Correct. These are two companies that lived through a 10-year bear market. And so they exercise and they sort of drive this home on every earnings call, supply discipline. We will not produce uranium unless we know that it has a home in long-term contracts. And so we have seen them cut production, yes, but it's really about them operating below their nameplate capacity. And that's not to say that if uranium prices go to $150 a pound, that this new capacity comes online straight away, that will only ever be driven by utilities coming to market and saying, we want to contract for 10 million pounds in 2035. And that's when you can start to add that incremental capacity.
Right. So it's a classic capital cycle. Behavior follows the bull or the bear, and then we move into the next stage. So with all of that thinking and work that you have done, you decided to partner with 5T on this fund. And I'm going to go back to this document here that you produced. You talk a little bit about the ambition, but let's start high level. What is it that you have built?
Over the last 6 years, with the work that we've done in nuclear, we've basically constantly been asked to set up a structure where investors can get exposure to this theme, but don't want to manage it themselves. And so the genesis of 5T nuclear was to provide investors an accessible product to get exposure to the entire nuclear value chain, not just in uranium, but also the opportunities that we see in what will be probably a $4 trillion capex cycle over the next 25 years if we are to fulfill our nuclear ambition. And so the fund aims to capture exactly that. We are agnostic as to where we go within nuclear power, whether it's the companies that manufacture the small components or the reactor pressure vessels, the turbines that do the mining, that do conversion enrichment. We want to provide exposure to that entire sector. And we wanted to make it accessible. So this is a fund that offers monthly liquidity. And it was about us trying to identify, plugging in our work that we've done and sort of the forensic work that we've done in nuclear and plugging that into a best-in-class risk manager and a best-in-class portfolio manager. And we spent months iterating exactly what we wanted that to look like, which we'll talk about. And we launched in January of this year.
And just let's talk about the components in that portfolio, because that's part of the investment process. This is 90% public companies.
At the moment, it's 100% public companies. We have the option to do up to 10% in very late stage privates, where we see sort of very unique, compelling asymmetric risk reward, but it has to be on a 3 to 6 month conversion timeline. We offer monthly liquidity. We don't ever want to be in a position where we gate investors. We never would do that. And so so the privates is really for optionality. But at the moment, the fund is 100% invested in liquid stocks.
And in terms of your menu, which you can access to populate the fund, just give us a sense of, you know, how much market cap is out there and what your, you know, how much you have to choose from.
So the answer to that is a lot more than we had 5 years ago. We monitor about 150 companies within the nuclear investment universe. I would say that's fairly evenly split across fuel and across what we would refer to as the build out. So that's components, servicing, and then actually the SMR names and some of the utilities. And so we're screening 150 stocks within that. And what we would define that as any companies where at least 15% of revenues are related to the nuclear industry. The way that we sort of overlay our investment process to those 150 companies is we have a lot of legacy experience at Ocean Wall, meeting these businesses, a very strong network across the entire sector, and feel like we're sort of always one derivative or one connection away from meeting who we need to meet in this sector. The strategy itself really is foundational upon three pillars. First is active management. This sector, it's a volatile sector, and it really does require an active manager. A stock that potentially you love today, especially with sort of changes in geopolitics on almost a daily basis, can really, your investment theses can change and can be very, very fluid. So it is actively managed, and we are trading fairly frequently. The second pillar is the derivatives overlay, which is really to capture that volatility in the sector. You see implied volatilities in some of these names of 150%, particularly in some of the more sort of speculative growth type names, a lot of which are in the advanced nuclear SMR space. And then the short book, but it's not really a short book. It's about being opportunistically short as and where we see opportunities. And what we have seen in the last 5 years is we've seen 13 corrections of 20% or more using the ETF URA as the benchmark. And so it's about being able to capture some alpha on the short side when those cracks sort of start to show. And I think using an example of last year, November last year, you started to see a lot of these nuclear companies raising 20, 30% of their market cap in equity. Very, very opportunistic deals that were being backfilled overnight as bought deals by these larger banks. And that sort of started to slow down. And if you'd taken that as the top of the market, you could have saved yourself probably 20 to 30%. To the downside through the sort of last quarter of the year. So it's those types of things, sort of sentiment analysis, what we believe is being overbought, oversold, that feeds into the way that we think about actually allocations and how active we want to be in the market on a day-to-day basis.
So let's just talk about the mechanics. You are the investment advisor to the fund and the managers in Switzerland.
Correct. So Ocean Wall Investment Advisors 5T Capital, FINMA regulated fund manager based in Zurich. We have the fund manager, Daniel Berge, who's been a client and friend of Ocean Walls for 4 years since his previous role at UBS O'Connor, where he was managing energy transition capital and particularly interested in the nuclear industry. He joined 5T since we started the fund in January. And then Gerhard Schreiber, who has a 35-year history in risk management at places like Deutsche Bank. He had the first FINMA-regulated hedge fund. He won the EuroHedge Award in 2008 and was nominated in 2011, so has a bit of a knack for volatility. And so it's about us plugging that into to this sort of portfolio manager, risk manager platform. But it, you know, we're speaking every day, but Ocean Wall cannot make the investment decisions and cannot sit on the investment committee because of our sort of day-to-day job in corporate advisory and broking.
Right. So an investor prospectively looking at this is, and help me here, looking at, is it Swiss franc, dollar, euro denominated, first of all?
Correct. So yeah, exactly that. So three share classes.
Monthly liquidity, is there leverage?
No leverage.
There's no leverage. And the fee structure is?
1% management fee and a 15% performance fee with a ratchet for significant outperformance.
Right. And is that above a threshold?
So we use 2-year treasuries as a hurdle, risk-free rate.
I understand. Now, when I read the materials, it looked to me like you were being relatively modest in the initial funding of the vehicle. I'm mm-hmm. correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I read get to 100 million and then pause. Mm-hmm.
It's a really, really important point because we are not in the asset gathering game. Despite the fact that the sector has come a long way in the last 5 years, it remains a pretty small investment universe. And a lot of these names would be deemed sort of smaller micro cap names. And what we believe our edge is not necessarily how to value Cameco, because that's now a story that most of the sell side know pretty well. What we see as our edge is applying that sort of forensic approach to fundamental analysis and trying to identify the stocks that perhaps the larger sell side banks are not looking at. And I say that to your point around sort of 100 million hard cap for the time being until liquidity improves, because there are certain names that might trade $3 or $4 million a day, but we have very, very high in-house conviction and we want that to be material for the performance of the fund. And so we're not in, as I said, asset gathering mode. We're really looking to deliver performance. We've seeded the fund with $9 million of our own capital across Ocean Wall and across 5T on the same fee structure as everybody else. And this is really for us to benefit alongside investors.
And just give us a sense of what the portfolio looks like today.
So we're 15 to 25 names concentrated. I would say more of a skew towards the uranium side today. But I think the world is about to move beyond rhetoric, beyond saying we're going to triple nuclear capacity, beyond saying we're going to quadruple nuclear capacity like Trump has. And I think that there's going to be very large contracts for the build out names. So names like BWXT and names like sort of smaller names like Studsvik, the EPC contractors that are going to benefit, the people like GE, companies like GE Vernova, who announced numbers yesterday and announced a 200 gigawatt backlog for their gas turbines. It's really trying to, and it's fluid and it changes, but I think our Delta One play is always going to be uranium. We have a single stock limit of up to 10%, but we can have up to 20% in physical uranium because we see that as sort of the Delta One play. So at any given time, we can have up to 20% in physical via things like Sprott and via a yellow cake. But today, I would say it's more skewed in favor of what we believe will be a run-up in uranium prices in the sort of next 6 to 12 months. And then we want to be able to capture those companies that are going to benefit from these new types of contracts for actually new build nuclear power plants globally.
And whilst the thesis going back to supply and demand, you know, the push for electrification, you know, EV demand, et cetera, you know, appears to be very secular, you know, we all need to be cognizant that we can be tripped up in the investment sort of, you know, business. Mm-hmm. What keeps you awake at night?
For me, it's about, can we fulfill our nuclear ambition? And what we have seen is, I mentioned that we went from 0 to 300 gigawatts from 1970 to 1987. In the 40 years since 1987, we've only increased nuclear capacity by about 25%. So call it 400 gigawatts. And so what keeps me awake at night is that the world will continue to overregulate what is a completely proven technology that powers 9% of the world. And so my fear is that overregulation will continue to will force the industry to stagnate. And what that will do is it will allow uranium mines to start to come online, perhaps those who don't want to exercise as much supply discipline as the larger names. And then you'll start to see potential sort of surpluses in uranium. So that's one thing. I think another thing that people talk about a lot is fusion and the ability for fusion to provide this sort of abundant, limitless, renewable energy. We spend time with the UK Atomic Energy Agency, which is our sort of domestic fusion powerhouse here in the UK at Culham Campus in Oxfordshire. And they're very candid about the advancements that they're making, but also the fact that this remains years away. So I think a breakthrough in fusion could be additive to the energy transition, but is something that we monitor as a potential risk. I think the final thing is on the funding side. And this comes down to China's able to build these reactors for $3 billion. In the Western world, it's about five times that. And so are we going to see the private sector step up in a way that will actually support these new reactors being able to be funded? And we saw last year in New York, the 14 largest banks in the world all commit towards funding new nuclear projects. But ultimately, they're not going to do that unless they see these reactors being built in a cost-effective manner. So it's going to be about whether we can actually start to build these effectively. And this is what the promise of SMRs and small modular reactors is, which is applying production line economics to nuclear power and being able to replicate those reactor on reactor and sort of that cookie cutter Henry Ford model. And so seeing that thesis come to fruition, I think is going to give definitely the financial world, the policymakers, capital markets is going to give it a lot more confidence to actually get to work in nuclear power. I think, as I mentioned, the fund is really designed for everyone. The minimum investment sizes are $100,000. It offers monthly liquidity, and we're really trying to capture not just what is a moment in time, but what we think is a multi-decade thesis. And so, I can be reached on ben@oceanwall.com for anyone that has any interest.
So I have been looking forward to this conversation. I have referred to uranium over the last few years in various interviews that we've conducted on the wider Inner Money Maze channel. As I, full disclosure, I own Cameco and I own Sprott and have been invested. I was rather early in Cameco and saw my investment halve before it's done substantially better. But patience is often, required. But I think what you've done, and thank you, is summarize the demand supply situation, which is potent. And the demand, you talked about that price inelasticity and equally the absence of substitution, which is, and just how small it is in the aggregate cost, so I think that supply demand picture, is unusual. I think that the vehicle that you have described, for investors wanting to, you wanted to get invested in this, but not having the expertise, I understand it's, it's got what people want, which is liquidity and visibility. And I think that this is still a niche area. But if you're a global investor and you're wanting exposure to, broad energy, coal may not have been the flavor of anyone, but as we've seen from, this current war, which probably won't be the last, strategic imperative of multiple energy sources, and even with, the energy transitions that the world is undergoing, we know when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't, blow, we need to turn on our lights and run on electric cars and all the rest of it. So it's a fascinating area. We'll be watching it closely. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me.